The Anton Savage Show on News Talk.
Brought to you by Standard Life. Retirement specialists getting you ready for your second life.
With me is Conor Lenehan, former Minister of State, Gary Murphy, Professor of Politics at DCU, and Gabia Gadavistacha, political journalist. And Gabia's paper, still your paper? Tis still your paper. Gabia's paper has a poll this weekend, Ireland Thinks, looking at the full of the political landscape, including state of the parties and state of the presidential election. Interesting on the presidential election. The stat of how many people don't care is fairly high. About a third of people couldn't give a rat's.
So actually, if you look at the responses to the questions, such as, you know, which of the following candidates would you vote for in the presidential election? Who should Fianna Fáil run? What should Sinn Féin do? Who should be the Sinn Féin candidate? All the answers that have the highest percentage points are the ones that are basically don't know, don't care. So, you know, this narrative about Sinn Féin saying, look, it's a bit too late for us to say who we might put onto the pitch because people are not very interested yet. Look, I don't know how true that rings, given as most of the other parties now have made up their minds, but they might be onto something there, you know?
They managed to avoid a fair bit of spotlight about their failure to get a candidate. I mean, Fianna Fáil came under fierce pressure, and there was a lot of criticism of Micheál Martin for taking so long to cough up Jim Gavin. That hasn't been the case with Sinn Féin. I don't get the sense they're under the same pressure.
No, they are under pressure. You know, there was names kind of circulating Fianna Fáil over the weeks and the months, you know, of course, the Seafra O'Learys and the Deirdre Heenans and, you know, one or two other names. But, like, we haven't really had names circulate Sinn Féin apart from Mary Lou MacDonald because she put herself sort of out there. Michelle O'Neill, perhaps, you know, TDs such as Rose Conway Walsh or Piers Doherty, they'd be kind of seen as, you know, this is who we put forward if we don't really have anybody else. There's reports in the Sunday Times today where TDs now are telling Mary Lou MacDonald, look, I don't think you should put yourself forward. There is still a cohort that believes that they should back Catherine Connolly, albeit it is a little bit late. Catherine Connolly declared herself earlier in the summer. The Sunday Independent Ireland Thinks poll, I will say, like the three candidates that we know for sure will be on the ballot, Heather Humphreys, Jim Gavin, Catherine Connolly, they're fairly neck and neck. So really, all eyes on Sinn Féin now. They meet for their thinking this week and they've said that they're going to announce what they're doing about the presidency after the Ard Corley meets on the 20th of September. But like, you know, 21% for Heather Humphreys, 20% for Jim Gavin, 20% for Catherine Connolly. You know, if Sinn Féin were to put in a strong candidate, they would have a really good chance, I think.
Although all of that in the context of what you said at the start of the large proportion of don't knows, those numbers come with 40% of people still up for grabs. Gary, you want to come in?
Well, no, there are two points I think to make about Sinn Féin in particular. One is why a party which has Irish unity as its whole raison d'etre would not run a candidate who could put a vision forward for Irish unity and instead leave it to a person who has no record of supporting unity in Catherine Connolly. And what would it say to those who might vote Sinn Féin at some stage in the future that they don't have an opportunity to vote for the Sinn Féin candidate but have to vote for someone who, you know, has no relationship with Sinn Féin whatsoever? Of course Catherine Connolly would want Sinn Féin support, whether that would be financial, but it would certainly, there are a lot of Sinn Féin voters who will do, I think, what the Sinn Féin party want them to do, and if Sinn Féin said, oh, we're supporting Catherine Connolly. But like, if you're in a political party and there's a presidency, it comes up only once every 7 years. If you're really serious, you run Mary Lou MacDonald. If she doesn't want to run, fair, so be it, and there are huge risks, of course. But I cannot for the life of me think why a serious political party would not run a candidate.
Well, isn't the counter-argument that there has been pressure on Sinn Féin to be part of or the leader of a more coherent left and that this would be a big gesture in that way, and also they'd save a big giant pile of money?
I don't even think the money is that significant. It, like, obviously in the six figures, but you know, Sinn Féin, as we know, are not short of money. But like, the next general election is 4 years away. Politics is of the here and now. There is an election. Sinn Féin is a national brand. It talks about unity above all else, border polls. They're forever telling people that the next president has to put unity at the top of their agenda. So why wouldn't they run a candidate?
So what do you think, Conor? Is there a prayer that they will throw their lot in with Catherine Connolly?
I have no idea. I know there's a huge division within Sinn Féin. I spoke to somebody, obviously as a journalist in the Peace Boss and been involved, I would know quite a few people there. And there seems to be a very strict division between what we would call the more left-wing members of their party and the traditionalists, the Army Council being part of the traditionalism. And very much, I think, you've nailed it there in your last comment, that the traditionalists and possibly the Army Council wish to have a candidate who advocates for Irish unity, and they say there must be a candidate. But the we call them the new beast, the liberal left-wingers in Sinn Féin, they want to kind of outreach to the broad left, and that would be a better electoral. This is the kind of
and can you
sophistication
not
that it preaches. Well, I think it is a bit incredible for a major party, and I would include Fianna Fáil, my old party, in that regard, that Micheál Martin and others were pushing at leadership level at one point that they wouldn't have a candidate, that there was no need to have a candidate. You know, this was going on. And then they were forced to have a candidate because Mairead McGuinness dropped out. And they were forced to produce a candidate because the backbenchers started feeling we could win this. And then they picked, as we know, Jim Gavin. Not a drama in this election so far. You know, Mairead McGuinness dropping out unexpectedly. Bertie Ahern not having phone calls. I mean, that's caused a huge...
What do you make of that?
That's caused huge resentment within the party. Because
why?
Whatever else about his flaws and appearances in tribunals, people have a great respect for what he did in the peace process. And they feel the way he was treated, that the fact that they didn't give him the courtesy of returning his calls or organising a meeting to discuss the possibility of his candidacy. This has been taken very badly in Fianna Fáil.
Was there a sense that
in the sense
if you think about it,
in News Talk
of getting the nomination,
you're ignored for a better position here within News Talk. But not only are you ignored, you're making requests to see, is it possible I could get this? And then what happens is suddenly you're told in the newspaper
not really the same
that
thing.
the leader is backing somebody else who's
not even Anton's not involved
who's
in my view.
Who's not even in News Talk.
Thank you very much.
You know what I mean?
I've always had a bank account.
Just to clarify.
But what I'm saying is that this whole dragging out of him was seen to be very unseemly and very unprofessional for the party.
But did the party ever think, could Bertie Ahern really have believed that the Fianna Fáil party could throw their lot in with them? That the senior members of the party would stand up and be seen to support him and defend on air and in public all of the stuff to do with Mahon and all of that?
Well, yeah, I know that was always an occupational hazard of having him as a candidate, but he is a very credible candidate in my view and a prominent person who could win a significant vote.
Would you vote for him?
I certainly would vote for him, yeah. I would, and I said publicly he's a very viable candidate because his record abroad and in this country in terms of promoting the country abroad, and we're going to have to do that in the next few years because things are going to tighten up around here. I think he had the credibility for the office.
And dig out now, the envelopes and whip around.
I understand the anxieties and nervousness at the leadership element. But I do think if you listen to that interview that Bertie Ahern gave at that De Valera commemoration up at the in Glasnevin, I think it kind of is not a very good sign of a party if you've a senior and somewhat distinguished, I think I'll just leave it at that, former Prime Minister Taoiseach, who's just kind of dragged, strung out for about a year.
Oh, yeah.
And I think that's really, it's not really good news for
Gary has thoughts.
Now. Well,
Gary.
Yeah, indeed. I have great admiration for Bertie Ahern and, in fact, nominated him for an honorary doctorate in DCU, which we gave him. And it was, there were protesters from the Connolly Youth, who still exist, Anton, you'll be glad to know, protesters throwing brown envelopes and whatever. And he handled it very well, really, and you know, all dissipated within a minute or two. And but my admiration for him doesn't go as far as to say that I think he would be a good candidate for Fianna Fáil, because he's Fianna Fáil past, and there are people voting in November or October now who weren't even born when Bertie Ahern last ran for an election in 2007, when you would have run, Connor, and the glory days of Fianna Fáil and the three election wins in a row. So what would it say of Fianna Fáil as this new vibrant party under Micheál? And remember, in Fianna Fáil currently, it's usually what Micheál wants, Micheál gets. And I just think it would have sent the signals that Fianna Fáil is not forward-looking, but is sort of stuck in a weird sort of loop.
Just to explain how activists could be rankled by this, and it's a very significant one. Micheál Martin was quoted in one of the national newspapers, I think it was the Irish Independent, actually, saying that even if Bertie Ahern was selected by his parliamentary party,
he wouldn't vote for him.
I mean, that was not a thing a chief executive of an outfit says at any stage.
But I think it's interesting. Like,
if that was said about you again in the continuity text, you and your new organization, the BBC, I don't think you'd be happy.
But Micheál was very, I think, it's interesting how Simon Harris, like, it's very clear that he prefers Heather Humphreys as the party's nominee, you know, when Sean Kelly expressed that he wanted to run for it. But actually, Micheál Martin was very clear in saying, you know, I want Jim Gavin. Billy Kelleher, God love him, even though he's been with the party for a very long time. Like, Micheál Martin didn't mince his words at all about who he was backing. Yeah. And that's kind of unusual, isn't it, in political parties, that if you have, you know, people that are contending for the same position, the leadership wouldn't really express a view and it's up to the membership to make up their own mind. I don't think Bertie Ahern ever had a chance of being the party's nominee. Like, I think Micheál Martin is, you know, and the people around him, they know that it will pose a lot of very awkward questions around it. If you look at the CMAT song, you know, all the Bertie's on there, all their envelopes, it just would put a very bad taste, I think, in the mouths of voters if he was to run.
What do you make of his 35-minute voicemail to supporters?
I actually think it's good that he came out and recorded the voice note, because we don't kind of hear him defend himself too much. We hear some of the questions that are posed to him. And of course, there was that famous interview where he was asked about the Mahon Tribunal with a foreign correspondent. And he, of course, got up and walked out of the interview. So it was quite interesting to hear him defending himself and kind of laying out the ground rule. And I thought, good for him, if that's what he feels that he has to do. Fair play to him. He's obviously not happy with the leadership. And I think Mary Hanafin was the other former senior Fianna Fáil figure who also wanted her name on the ticket. She came out and she said, look, you know, maybe I could have been given a phone call. And perhaps that's not the worst point in the world to make. You've served, given the party a lot of your life. And, you know, perhaps a phone call would have not only stopped all the speculation, if you're told, look, we're not going to go with you, we're going to go with somebody else. But then the question automatically is, well, if you're not going to go with me, who are you going with? And Jim Gavin was somewhat of a surprise when his name emerged in recent weeks.
But why did Bertie Ahern do a 35-minute voice note? I mean, Bertie Ahern has, throughout his entire career, been known for carefully, strategically planned circumspection when it is useful to him. It is unusual for him to put on record a half-hour whinge, complaint, give out, justification, whatever. Why do it in this context?
I don't know. It's a sort of very politically scientific answer to that. But it's like, it's very unusual, because he's not unused to being in radio studios now. I remember I was sat with him in this studio when we did election coverage back in November for the general election, and he was here. He was an RT. Mm-hmm. He was all over, but he has done interviews. I think the one with,
yeah, is, but there's Spiegel, that, not on that topic
that Gabby talks about. I mean, the issue there was, I think what I understand is that was a peace process interview, and then suddenly the interviewer went off peace. Now, you might say that's the interviewer's prerogative, and I admired him for getting up and saying, sorry, pal, I agreed to the one thing, and you know, I don't go by your boat.
Ah, come on, Gary.
Well, this is the journalist in you. But,
that's appalling comment. Nothing. You're asked questions, you should answer them. And like, this is somebody, and even then I think he was asked, you want to be on the presidential ticket, so surely these are all questions that you should answer.
We should answer them in the context of a presidential campaign. I mean, I wasn't convinced he was serious about running at all, and that he was kind of stringing people along, saying, oh, I'm not out of the race, but I'm not in it either. And then suddenly he sends this weird voice note, to be perfectly frank. And it would be an odd way for his career to end on a 35-minute voice note into the ether.
What did you make of it, Connor?
Well, funny enough, I took the trouble to actually listen to it, because I do understand and know that Bertie was very serious about putting his name and making it available to the party. And I do believe in credibility. And because, let's be honest about, you know, the elephant in the room here is that it is a lacking. The field is, I suppose, with the exception of Bob Geldof now, it's an unremarkable, mediocre field that's come into position. There's nothing standoutly totally exciting about Heather Humphreys, nor indeed about Jim Gavin. And it's noticeable that all three of the leading candidates from the leading parties, Humphreys, Gavin, Mary Lou, in this poll, are polling less than their party ratings in the last general election. So this means this contest is wide open. I would say that Humphreys is in the best position, because in the narrow poll of only three candidates, she's on 20, and she has more or less the same 21 in the wider field. But the level of disinterest are undecided. It's 40% in the narrow field, and it's 20% in the shorter field of the wider field again. So, like, I think that these presidential elections, these polls last a nanosecond, because we saw Casey go from 1% to 20%.
Yeah, we're 7 weeks out.
In a week in the last presidential election.
So we saw in 2011 the whole campaign change in the last week completely after this, or the Sean Gallagher implosion on whatever.
Frontline, wasn't it?
Frontline, yeah. And then subsequent appearances. And Michael D, who was sort of saintly in the middle of that debate, saying very little came and won quite comfortably.
That was the best non-presidential elections ever.
And presidential elections obviously don't correlate to general elections. I mean, who remembers poor old Gay Mitchell, who got the princely sum of 6.4% only 9 months after his party got 36% in a general election? Fine Gael. So in that context, I suspect that the polling of Noe and Kevin Cunningham, the pollster, who's a very good analyst, makes the point that really it's things will become much clearer in 3 or 4 weeks' time when we know who's on the ballot and we see them wandering around the country in their electric buses.
Very interesting on that note, how many people, and this reflects text that we get a lot, there are an awful lot of people say positive things about Jim Gavin and his role in the GAA. A lot more people point out that it was related to Dublin. Hi Anton, why would I vote for a Dublin football manager to be president, says a West Cork listener. Another agreeing with Connor, looks very shoddy that Bertie did not get a shot by FF. However, Micheál is a long game player and is broadly speaking doing a good job. There's other political stories in the Sunday Independent this weekend, particularly excerpts from Leo Varadkar's new political memoir, in which he has said, Gabi, if I understand this correctly, essentially that the investigation into him for leaking confidential documents could be perceived to be revenge for his role in the Maurice McCabe.
Yeah, so a long time awaited, this memoir from former Taoiseach Leo Varadkar, who I think stepped down and it was fairly clear very early that he would write some sort of a book. And we've been sitting on the edges of our seats waiting for this book and all the drama that hopefully it will contain. I don't know how much drama it's going to contain, but there is some interesting points being made in the excerpts in publishing the Sunday Independent today. This is the Leo the Leak affair, of course, first published in the Village magazine over his leaking of a confidential document. He details how, you know, he went into a Garda station and he gave an interview on a Sunday. You know, listeners will recall he sent the agreement between the government and the Irish Medical Organisation to Matthew O'Toole, which is the head of a rival doctors' organisation, the National Association of General Practitioners. The document was marked confidential, but it didn't have the red stamp to mark it as a government secret. And he's saying, look, the investigation was quite of a harrowing experience. And then, of course, excuse me, if you'll remember, we had this unusual rotating Taoiseach deal, and that was quite new at the time. And so the argument was there, when Micheál Martin finishes up as Taoiseach and it's Leo Varadkar's turn to take over, can a Taoiseach that's being investigated by Gardaí, potentially maybe even being charged, can an individual like that take the office of the Taoiseach? And the excerpt says he made the decision, look, if I am charged, I'm going to resign. There's no way you can have a Taoiseach that's being investigated by Gardaí. But then later on, he sort of persevered. He said the parliamentary party, of course, was getting tetchy. And I remember that from my own reporting at the time. Also, listeners may recall there was a video, of course, that was doing the rounds of the Taoiseach kissing somebody in a nightclub. He's going into that story as well. He's saying, look, it was quite, it really avoided a media storm, but he's kind of saying it was a night that kind of got out of hand. So some interesting
this
stuff.
One on the, so this is the one, this was a nightclub video recorded in where he might have believed that it was a private setting of him kissing a man who wasn't his partner. And the revelation in the excerpt suggests, the way that he phrases it, I think, is that he was kissing this guy. And I think he says that his partner was in the room but unable to take the phone of the person recording it.
So I think the friend spotted that somebody was videoing it. His partner was with him, but they didn't get to grab the phone. And the next day it was actually somebody who was the government press secretary, went on to be the government press secretary under Simon Harris, Chris Donoghue, formerly of this parish, texted Leo Varadkar and said, look, this video is on TikTok of you kissing this man. It's blowing up. It's getting a lot of views. And I think actually Leo Varadkar says that he actually rang the man in the video and told him. I think he wasn't out to his family. And the man was saying, well, I can't really identify me. But Leo does kind of say, look, the media didn't kind of report on it too much, even though I think the video got something like 2 million views. It really did the rounds. And of course, if you recall, the Finnish minister, Sienna I'll forget her second name now. Was it Maren?
Yes, it was.
There was videos of her dancing, of course, and partying. And that ultimately led to her resignation. And Leo seems
thankful
that she didn't
go that way. Between traditional media and digital media, that 2 million views on something that largely traditional media were circumspect about and were fairly reserved about. The other thing that he talks about, Connor, is his lasting dislike and resentment between him and Phil Hogan.
Yes, well, it's hardly surprising. I firmly believe that Phil Hogan was pretty instrumental in him departing from his job. And I think you could understand that from Phil's perspective. Phil is very influential within the Fine Gael party. And I think he took the view that this man had been unkind to me. And I'm going to do something about it.
Is there anything in that, Gary, that surprised us? Or would we have been fairly able to infer that there wasn't a lot of love between the two men?
No, I mean, it's pretty self-evident that Phil and Leo have a bit of history. Probably going back to 2010 when Leo, as a trusting young Turk in Fine Gael with people like Simon Coveney and Brian Hayes and others, rode in behind Richard Bruton in perhaps the most inept ever leadership heave in modern history, and were astonished when Big Phil started rallying the troops for Enda. And now I must make a quick admission here, Anton. I've read Leo's book cover to cover because I am reviewing it for the August Telegraph, no less, next weekend. So I can't comment too much about it, but there is a review by Mary Regan.
You can't comment too much about it. That's why you can comment about it, Gary. Give us the dirt.
Yeah, Mary Regan has
what details
has a
did
good
you discover?
Well,
are there good bits?
I found it a bit underwhelming. It's underwhelming and it's self-congratulatory and it is... like it's typical Leo in one way. All the successes are his and all the failures are cumulative. And I say no more.
That'll be published when in the Telegraph?
Next weekend. But Mary Regan has a very detailed review in the People section of the Sunday Indo today, which I think is the first review. It's been launched, I think, to no doubt in front of a huge crowd on Wednesday night.
He had an opportunity, didn't he, to come out and to say... this is what happened during this government that was thrown together, Fianna Fáil, Fine Gael, going into bed together for the first time with the Greens, propping them up. This is what it was like in the cabinet meetings. This is my relationship with Micheál Martin. This is what Eamon Ryan was actually like. And so that's kind of what I was hoping to read. I don't know, I'm not too excited by the excerpts today, but does it get better? Gary doesn't think so.
I don't.
53106 if you want to text us. That'll cost you 30 cents or 087-1400.
There's a lot of dead Taoiseachs being thrown around this studio this morning.
No.
We are going to...
Former Taoiseach, not dead yet.
Oh, no.
I meant it in the metaphorical sense, of course.
No.
But they've been chopped up here today at a great rate. Are we any more now that we can bring on after the commercial break?
Coming up after the break, we're going to be talking about...
Eddie Kenny.
No, we leave former... we're going to talk about another former Taoiseach, this in the form of Simon Harris, because there's a story about Simon Harris's response.
More victims. More victims.
To the threats and intimidation that have been foisted upon, not him, but his family, which seemed deeply egregious. We'll be addressing that after this break. There's a number of papers covering the threats that have been made to the Taoiseach, Simon Harris, particularly to the children the wife and family of the Taoiseach, Simon Harris. As I understand it, Kabir, this is on social media that these threats have been given, and they seem to be of the most horrendous end of the spectrum.
Yeah, look, politicians and figures in the media are no stranger to abuse online. It is almost part and parcel of politics and participation in the media nowadays, and you'll hear a lot of politicians talk about, especially women actually usually, saying how vile abuse is and how that is one of the major facts that really deters them from doing their job and putting themselves into political participation. But this seems to have reached a new level now. Taoiseach Simon Harris, really facing very quite serious threats. Ali Bracken reporting in the Sindo how a vile threat to a close family member of the Taoiseach has been made, and that sparked a new security concern and described by him as an attempt to intimidate me out of public office. In the statement he's saying, what me and my family have faced in recent weeks is not debate. It is abuse, intimidation. It is behaviour that should never ever be treated as normal, and no one is to blame except those who are choosing to make the abuse and make the threats. I think the elephant in the room here a little little bit is the social media companies, on the platforms on which these, you know, abuse and threats are made, and have really full reign to thrive, to grow, and there's really no limitations around them over how bad they can be. And obviously Gardaí are taking these threats very seriously because they seem to be very grave. You know, even he's saying last week, direct threats were made against my children. Like, I think everybody agrees that the children of a politician, you know, they're not the ones putting their faces on posters. They're not, their names are not on the ballot, and they should really have no part in any abuse that, or any criticism that perhaps their parent gets. Really, I think, quite a new low when it comes to the security surrounding politicians. And for a couple of years now, we've had this debate over, you know, when is the book going to stop? And when does it, like, do we have to wait for a politician to be killed for something to be done? We know the government is trying to clamp down on social media companies. You know, ministers have previously described them as being the Wild West for teenagers, for example, and children under the age of 16, and potential social media ban. But really, like, when it comes to politicians being directly targeted, what does that mean for democracy and the participation of your average Joe into politics, if that's what they choose to do, but they may be put off by doing it because of how bad...
But presumably, it must have a chilling effect on those who are already in politics. Mm. I mean, if you know that you finish your daily job and you go home to your spouse and that spouse says, our children were threatened with physical violence or death, I was threatened with the most horrendous forms of physical violence, it's hard to get up the next morning and say, well, I just put that totally out of my head.
So we know that cabinet ministers, of course, have a guard with them. And actually, even in reading the excerpts of Leo Varadkar's book, he's saying even when he was in the club and mother, he had plainclothes Gardaí with him in the club. So, like, there is protection there. But we know, of course, the Taoiseach does not live in Framley, which is the official residence. The Taoiseach lives in his own house. And that was the issue that Simon Harris had when he was Taoiseach. You know, he lives in a regular house, in a housing estate. And so if people wanted to go and protest, they could do that. And there was protesters outside of his house, outside of Stephen Donnelly's house when he was health minister, outside of Roderick O'Gorman's house when he was minister as well. Holding
and
Varadkar
as well, wasn't there?
And Leo Varadkar's house.
I was going to point that out.
And so the point is, like, what's the level of protection there? And if you have one or two guards with you, okay, they can protect you to an extent. But what if the crowd is 15, 20, 30 people? You know, it really can get quite dangerous. And of course, your family might say, like, is this worth it?
Was this always the case, Conor? It just happened in real life rather than on social media? Or is this a new problem?
It's a new problem, and it's almost entirely a byproduct of online social media, the arrival of online, which has its benefits in terms of public participation. But there's a one of my older advisors and one of the ministers say it's the Green Ink Brigade. Years ago, maybe lots of the listeners out there won't even know the reference, but years ago, and certainly in my early days in the Dáil, I'd had a file called the fan mail, I ironically call it. And these were kind of toxic letters that come in. And I think over the period, I got about 10 to 12. And these would be very toxic letters. And weirdly, some of them would be written in red ink or green ink. And the green ink seemed to be the most vicious ones, you know.
From the green ink comes down to margins.
And there would be threats. And one of the 12 I did have to send to the guards. I just said, it's not me reading it. Like, the secretary would give it to me. And I said, all right. I said, look, you better send that one to the guards just in case. Because the writing in the letter had escalated to the level of you should be killed or whatever, you know. And I wasn't getting very sensitive about it. But it's very intense now. My cousin Angus is a councillor in Athlone, and he says the level of abuse of councillors who are basically unelected. They're like the voluntary side of the political. They're not professionals. They're not being paid. They're voluntary, really, in a way. And they're getting a level of abuse now where they all have to maintain two phones. And, you know, there's a phone for the public. Like, in my day, my phone was my phone. So the constituents had my phone. Nowadays, I don't think anybody in politics would contemplate giving their personal mobile out. So the ones that you see on their leaflets, that they're not available to answer those. But because the sheer abuse that's coming is just... And what's happening, I think it's wrong, by the way, the key point, but there's a common thread to some of these. The way Joan Burton was treated in Jobstown was ridiculous. She was basically kidnapped by a hostile mob. And the way Varadkar's house was staked out, and now Harris said, there has to be a law against this. I mean, are protesters, legitimate protesters about an issue, whether it's downturn, and we went through a lot of that in the downturn, are they entitled to physically intimidate somebody when they're, you know, in their own private time, in their own private...
But also threats to the family. I mean, whatever about the Green Ink Brigade writing to you personally, when you're receiving threats to your spouse, when you're receiving threats about your children, I mean, that's a horrendous way to have to live your life. When you're dealing with undergraduates, Gary, is there... is this the kind of thing that would put that generation off politics, do you think? Or are they used to it because that's just what social media is?
They're probably used to it in the terms of they, you know, they live their lives on their phones. But weirdly, the statistics tell us that there is no shortage of people wanting to run for office.
Really?
No, yeah. Look at the last general election. There were more candidates than ever before and more people wanting to get on the ticket. And the same with the local election. So, like, counterintuitive, you would say, like, who the hell would want to run for politics? And, you know, I've been teaching and writing and talking for a long time. And, I mean, the toxicity of the abuse is just, like, shocking. And, of course, it's all spawned by the fact that most of these people can be anonymous online or, like, you know, X247, whatever is their handle on whatever social media app they prefer to use. And it's this anonymity seems to give them carte blanche to do anything. It's outrageous.
But there's one thing, an interesting view of politics, because you are a political correspondent, you're a former politician, you're an academic in the area. Would you advise somebody to go into politics? Gary, if you were asked, you say, yeah, it's a good job.
Obviously, the sort of the academic political scientist me would say, of course, we need good people in politics. And Simon Harris is a good person. Anyone who's ever met him, he is a good person. Mm-hmm. And like the abuse he gets, and
would you advise somebody to do it?
He seems to get it more than most. I mean, for whatever reason, I've written critical articles about him, but I don't know him. But he seems a very good person. Anytime I've met him, I would because Connor? I think we need good people in politics.
I have encouraged people. I mean, if you ask about my own children, of which I have five, would I encourage them? Some of them are keen on politics, but certainly three of the five have no interest.
But you would encourage them if they were interested?
If they were interested, I would, of course, yes.
I think you have to be a certain kind of person to do it.
What kind of person?
I think you have to sort of believe that what you're doing is truly right and see through all the criticism and say, no, I'm right and that's it. I think if you are, you have to be very thick-skinned to do it.
Anna, you wanted to make a point there.
No, just my youngest daughter, Aoife. She sort of expressed an interest in it, all right. You know, she's very young, she's only 17. So, but my father never encouraged any of us to go for it, and he allowed us to make our own minds up. And I think that's probably the best parenting approach to this. But to other people, I think there is an absolute moral need for people to encourage people to run for political office.
But this is kind of serious stuff. I mean, two politicians were killed in Britain in the last 10 years. Joe Cox and David Ames, one from Labour, one from the Conservative side. We've seen Mary Lou MacDonald being abused and a person charged in connection with that.
We've seen politicians be stalked, particularly female politicians.
You know, your question's very, very astute in one way, but like it would be a very difficult choice for people to make. But there is no shortage of people who want to be on the ballot. I think that is a good thing.
It is worth pointing out, Noreen O'Sullivan, former Garda Commissioner, sat in the chair where you are sitting when she had finished the task force looking at politician safety, and she said very clearly she has a real concern that we are going to see somebody get hurt.
Some sort of violence. I could well imagine it happening. And we shouldn't say these are just kind of nut jobs anonymously on the internet, because we've seen it happen just across the water.
I would point out too, it's particularly invidious this to women and female participation in politics, because I even had nervous moments and I insisted on having somebody in my clinics, which were, you know, 7 o'clock in the evening every Monday in Tala when I was a TD. But I had to stop that because, you know, the danger of somebody, I had to either have somebody with me or have somebody else stand in for, because things anger and people coming in and, you know, so, but that's even to the power of 10 for women. Like the idea of a woman being alone doing a clinic TD, and there have been incidents, I think, with some of the female TDs in the Dáil. That's not publicised. It's a serious disincentive.
There's a certain extent, though, I think when it's online, you can kind of close the laptop or turn off the phone if you absolutely have to. But I think in the case of Simon Harris that we're talking about here, it's when Gardaí are very concerned and they're very worried. And that's when it transpires into almost reality. You're kind of going, okay, this is a new level now. And I think it's crossing that threshold from cyber into reality, that is the danger there.
And there is a kind of a perception that politicians are sort of weird, exotic creatures. But these are our peers. You've seen, you questioned them all here in this studio. Like Simon Harris got like, 20-odd thousand votes in the general election in November. So people are voting. Thousands of people voted for Connor. So what then gives the right for some bozo on social media to make, like, whether they're outlandish or outrageous, whatever, you know, violent threats? It's a scandal.
It seems as long as there is no evidence of anybody ever getting prosecuted for that, there's very little in the way of a disincentive.
And the odd person who does get kind of prosecuted almost inevitably has some sort of issue.
Connor?
Yeah, well, there's no final word in that other than, you know, you're in that delicate area that was covered in the papers there, but Graham Linehan, by the way, no relation of mine, he's Linehan.
Spells his name differently. That says it all, Connor.
You're always pitted with this free speech argument on social media and then the abuse. And I think...
Well, there's no free speech for threats.
The turn that's happened here with social media is that the green ink, the ad hominem personalised attack has become the norm, whereas before it was the exception. And it's a kind of unpleasant thing that
And
happened.
There's also a factor where the Green Ink Brigade are able to find each other and form a club and reinforce the views.
They can figure out where you live very easily. Yeah. They can track your movements. They know where your constituency office is. They know where your home address is. And then they're turning up outside of your door, but, you know, even on a Friday evening, Saturday,
but
Sunday.
Having said that, I'm still mystified why public figures, and I mean public figures in the wider sense, could include yourself as a broadcaster, why they publicise and have these selfies with their families or their homes in the background, mm-hmm. because it's deadly, because you can be stalked through this.
To be very careful.
Well, that's a point that Anthony Nyland, the head of content in Virgin Media, is actually making as well. They've just done their launch this week and he's in the papers talking about how so many of their frontline presenters are getting the kind of abuse. And I see Anna Daly talking about the kind of abuse that she would have received when she was on air. Text read presidential election. I am a very politically engaged 38-year-old, not affiliated with any party. I don't like any of these candidates and for the first time may not vote. Which brings us back to where we started. 40% of people saying no interest.
Don't care, yeah.
Well, I bet you that person will vote. I bet you they'll vote. If they're politically engaged, they're going to vote because they won't be able to resist going into the ballot, going into the polling station.
Right, 7 weeks from now, text us back and tell us if you actually did vote and who you voted
for. Come in.
They need to have what they have in student unions, which is reopen nominations. RON is what it was called back when I was in college. That's what he should vote for.
Coming up after the news, we're going to be hearing in respect to the presidential election. Simon Harris has, of course, said that local councils aren't to, or Fine Gael members of local councils are not to give their support to independent candidates. Yeah. We'll hear from two independent candidates who are quite aggrieved with this and the impact it may have on their prospects for getting elected. If you have any thoughts, 53106 is the text line, or 087 1400 106 if you want to get us on WhatsApp. We'll also be looking at the traders, and a little bit later on in the programme, Jason Byrne will be dropping by. Big thank you to Gabia Gadavascache, political journalist, Gary Murphy, Professor of Politics at Dublin City University, and Conor Lenehan, former Minister of State.
The Anton Savage Show on News Talk.